As I share with you my discoveries over time about the laws of spirit, let's feel we're going for a walk together, or riding in your car, or just sitting in a room somewhere, considering some fundamental issues of all our lives. Albert Einstein once reminded us that God does not play dice with the universe. Some years ago, my mentor, an old man I met in a gas station late one night, whom I called Socrates, would respond to my various questions with a shrug and the words, "Well, it's the house rules." I didn't know what he meant by that at the time, but now it's become clear that what Socrates referred to and what Albert Einstein referred to were the laws of spirit, immutable principles that can make our lives work better. When I was a kid, I didn't know anything about these laws, at least consciously. And I looked around me, and I looked at my parents and the people they knew and the adult world, and I noticed many people didn't seem happy much of the time. Often they seemed confused, and that reflected my own state of consciousness. I wondered, what are the rules here? How does life work? And I began, even as a youth, to collect quotations and aphorisms and find wisdom wherever I could, reading books on Eastern philosophy and Western philosophy, to try to find out what would make my life work better. I knew there must be a key that I was missing somewhere, and many of us have probably had that feeling. When I grew older, I discovered an old trampoline in someone's backyard, and I felt like I was born a second time. I gradually found myself training and competing in the sport of gymnastics, and at least in that sport, I found a set of rules I could live with, that I understood. And later on, as a coach at Stanford University and a professor at Oberlin College, I began to teach beginning gymnastics and also train world-class athletes. And I had to search for new principles that would make sense of the hundreds of different movements we had to learn. And I did indeed discover underlying principles, laws of physics, principles of movement and learning, that would help people to be more successful. And only later did I realize that these principles also applied to any movement form, not just my sport, but any sport, including martial arts, dance, playing a musical instrument, any form of skill learning. And that was somewhat of a revelation, that these principles were broader than I'd first imagined. But, you know, being good at gymnastics and good at coaching didn't really help me when I went out on a date. When I had to learn to express myself, express my feelings, become vulnerable, to establish intimacy with someone else. And my athletic skills and training didn't really help much when it was time to raise children or determine my directions in life, my career directions, my right livelihood, or deal with the financial problems and challenges of life. So I began to seek broader principles, deeper principles that would apply to the bigger game of life. And that search led, over the years, to a number of different books, including The Laws of Spirit. What I want to share with you now are some keys to these laws to help prepare you to absorb the material, to integrate it, and make practical use of it in everyday life. Let me begin by sharing a story that happened some years ago when I was walking down the street in Berkeley, California, with Socrates. Now, during this time, I was going through a stage where I was doing a lot of work on myself. I was doing various kinds of meditations and inner work, contemplations, visualizations. I was practicing a Mongolian warrior form of self-massage to clear fear from the body. Much work directed at my body, my mind, my emotions. Well, during this time, Sok and I walked by some posters on a wall, and one of them was about oppressed peoples, and one was about starving children, another was saving whales and dolphins, and I turned to him as we walked and said, "You know, Sok, I feel kind of guilty or selfish or something, doing all this work on myself when there are so many people in need out there." And he just glanced at me and said nothing, kept walking. And I said, "Socrates, did you hear what I said?" And he stopped suddenly and turned toward me and said, "I'll give you $5 if you can slap me on the cheek. Come on, take a swing at me." And I said, "No, I've never hit an old man before." He said, you're not going to this time either. You have reflexes of a snail. Well, he finally goaded me into taking a swing at him. I figured it was some kind of test, so I threw a right hook or whatever and found myself suddenly on the ground in a rather painful wrist lock. As he let me up, Socrates said, you notice a little leverage can be very effective? Shaking my wrist, I said, yes, I noticed. He said, well, you want to help people. You want to save whales and dolphins and help oppressed peoples. That's wonderful. But you can't really help somebody else unless you first understand them. And it's very difficult to understand anyone else until you understand yourself. So if you want to really make a difference in life, find the commitment, the clarity, the courage, in order to know how and when to exert the right leverage in the right place at the right time. That made a lot of sense to me. And since that time, that's what I've been seeking to do. So when I convey information, it's not enough just to tell you things you can remember and to relate one law after the next. So I'd like to introduce these laws in a way that will open you up to making practical use of the material. Let's start by talking about the term spiritual law, because whenever somebody hears the term law, they think of crime and punishment, right and wrong, and moralisms of one kind or another, and that's doubled when you think about spiritual law. Those are big consequences, big punishments, and so on. Well, let me assure you that when I speak of spiritual law, it has nothing essentially to do with morality. That's a human invention. These laws transcend human life. Let's take, for example, a spiritual law that works through the physical domain. We call it the law of gravity. Now, if I ignore or resist the law of gravity while I'm rock climbing, that doesn't make me a bad person, does it? No, just possibly not very intelligent and maybe dead. So you see, these laws have nothing to do with right or wrong, being good or bad. They have to do with consequences. One of my favorite stories that helps convey this flavor of spiritual law is about a cook at a dude ranch in Montana. His name was Lee Song. He happened to be Chinese. And the cowhands there would always razz him and tease him because he was the cook. That's what they did to the cook. They'd put frogs in his bed and snakes in his boots. And when Lee Song discovered a snake or a frog or whatever, he'd startle it first and then he'd just get a big smile on his face and take the snake or the frog outside and go on with his business. Well, one of the cowboys, in a more philosophic moment one day, he was sober at the time, said, Lee Song, we're always razzing you and teasing you, and you never seem to get upset. Why is that? Is it because you meditate, or is it because of your Chinese ancestry? And Lee Song said, no, I don't think so. It's probably because every day I pee in the soup. Life is like that sometime, you know? We may think we're bending the rules or getting away with something, and we're not getting any apparent feedback about it, but eventually we learn from the consequences of our actions, that law of cause and effect. Has it struck you that life is a giant feedback system, a training ground? Sometimes life feels like a spiritual boot camp. And we're all humans in training, a HIT, H-I-T, human in training. In fact, it struck me that no one really needs a book or a tape or a teacher or a seminar to evolve as a human being. After all, we were evolving long before there were books or tapes or seminars. And why is that? Because daily life is guaranteed to teach us everything we need to evolve as human beings. Our relationships, our health issues, our financial issues, making decisions about our directions in life. These test us and strengthen us and teach us. All a book or a tape like this or a teacher can do is to help remind you of something you already know at some level, but maybe have forgotten, so that you can learn a little more from daily life. And that's all I can guarantee anybody. I can promise maybe to save you a little bit of time and a little bit of pain. That's the best I can do. I wish I could promise enlightenment. That's what I'd so much like to give. But in a sense, we all give that to one another. And one form of illumination is understanding and aligning our lives to these laws of spirit. Alan Watts once warned us, beware of teachers who pick your pocket and then sell you your own wallet. The irony of that statement is that's all any teacher can do, because the treasure is inside you. And I'm not just saying that to sound nice. It's so clear to me. The treasure is inside you. All I can do is to offer some keys to help unlock that treasure. And that's what these laws of spirit are about. So they are reminders of what you already know. They're not rules. We already have enough rules to follow in life. They're no more burdensome than a set of wings or a set of keys to unlock new doors. I've already said that since I was fairly young, I began to gather quotations and aphorisms to try to find principles that would make my life work better, and maybe principles I could share with others as well. So I began to collect aphorisms, and I found out some things that disturbed me, because what I thought was a wise saying ended up getting contradicted half the time. For example, how about that saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks? Well, maybe there's some truth to that, and yet another saying reminds us, you're never too old to learn. Well, let's try again. How about this one? Variety is the spice of life. Oh, but old shoes are easiest. Well, how about absence makes the heart grow fonder? There's a nice one. That certainly must be true. Oh, but out of sight, out of mind. One more try. He or she who hesitates is lost. But look before you leap. So you see how aphorisms contradict one another. Can we rely on them? Well, maybe some of the time. With some people. Now let's try a different kind of statement. A chain breaks at its weakest link. We aren't going to find anything to contradict that. And that's what makes something a law. You see, if you take 1,000 chains, 10,000 chains, and you decide to break every single one, you know for certain that every one of those chains is going to break at its weakest link, no exceptions. And that conveys the first quality that makes something a law rather than an aphorism or a wise saying. You can count on it. Every single time, it's consistent. Well, that would be good to know about chains if you happen to be in the hardware business. But the reason it's significant for all of us is because it's not just chains that break at their weak links, is it? So do we. Whether that link is physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, social, sexual, it doesn't matter. Where our weak link is, that's where we break. Now, that could be the subject of a whole other tape. I only use that to illustrate the second quality that makes something a spiritual law, and that is its universal theme. It applies across every domain, physical, emotional, mental, to every one of us at all times and every level of our being. So if something is consistent and universal, we can call it a spiritual law. We can absolutely rely on it. Now there's more to this picture. And speaking of picture, would you visualize for a moment a giant triangle set up like a pyramid? And down at the base of that pyramid, in the weeds, you can label from left to right A, B, C, D, E, and so on. Now, A might stand for the issue of education, you know, our education in life and educational directions and issues to better ourselves. B might be about our relationships. C might be health or fitness issues, something to do with our body. D might have something to do with our finances. E might be our career directions. F might be issues with family. G might be our location, where we're going to live, and so on. And then it goes on with inner work and psychological and spiritual growth. We have these different compartments, different issues we're working out in our lives. And you notice sometimes we work on one and work on one. All these areas have counselors, don't they? There are financial counselors, relationship counselors, educational counselors, career counselors. And often with the help of someone else or on our own, we finally solve an area. We resolve it. And then something pops up in another area. reminds me of a toy I once saw in Japan. It's a wooden box with rods sticking out of it, and if you push in one rod, another pops out. And that's often what happens in life. Trying to get ourselves all together is often like trying to eat once and for all. So we have one issue after the next in life. Sometimes we juggle a number of them. Well, now I'd like you to picture at the top of that pyramid, right at the apex, a big S. And that stands for Superman, Superwoman, or Spiritual Law. I'll let you guess which. That S is like a giant beacon that shines down equally on all those issues at the base of the pyramid. My point being that if you apply or align your life with even one spiritual law, that light will shine down, it will touch upon and heal and resolve and balance every area, whether it's education or relationships or health, finances, every area will impact. That's what I'm talking about when I mention exerting the right leverage on life. These laws are so powerful. You know, there are very few certainties in life. Very few certainties. In fact, we're not guaranteed to keep our relationship, our husband or wife or partner. We're not guaranteed to keep our children this lifetime, or our house, our money, even our beliefs. The only thing, in fact, we're guaranteed to keep for our entire life is our body. And it turns out that's only on loan. Very few certainties in this life. But if this life makes any sense at all, I can promise you, I can make one guarantee, one certainty. To the degree you align yourself with any of the laws of spirit I'm going to be sharing, your life will work better. It will look better, feel better, and work better on many levels. It has to. You see, each law I'm going to share is like a deep river flowing through your life. Very literally. Use that image. You can sit back and admire that river and say, oh, that's an interesting law, and take it in on a conceptual level. Or you can dive into it. Hold your nose, jump in, swim around. You can bathe in it. You can tap into that river to irrigate the garden of your life. And hopefully, surely, you can learn to swim with the current. Because the current of our lives, this river, is very subtle. And often life feels like a struggle to us because we don't realize we're swimming against the current. So these laws have a way of pointing out, hey, check out which way the current is flowing. And as we begin to swim with that, suddenly, even though we deal with many of the same issues, life starts to feel easier. We perceive it differently. We look through a cleaner, clearer set of filters at life. And that's how these laws work. Now the question might arise, how do you apply them? I mean, it sounds good, you know, Dan's going to relate laws to me in a few minutes. I can enjoy them and say, that makes sense. Sure, I knew that. I'd just forgotten, maybe. But how do you actually apply them to make them work? Well, let's say you told me you were going to be learning a swan dive off the high diving board. And I said to you, okay, that sounds great. I have a bit of advice. Just before you enter the water, stretch for the water. Really stretch. Now, would you have to simply remember that information? Would you have to wake up every morning and meditate on it? Would you have to contemplate it every day or repeat it as an affirmation? I don't think so. It's just when you go off the diving board and you're in midair, soaring through the air, and you're about to enter the water, that's when you go, that's right, stretch before I enter the water, and you do it. And in that moment, you apply the law. And that's how these laws work. In the moment you need them, they'll be there for you. It doesn't matter whether you conceptually or mentally remember them all. In fact, a friend of mine once reminded me, he said, Dan, if you can't remember something, just forget it. So the point being, you don't have to remember them and carry them around in your head. I'm going to be sowing seeds the way I transmit these laws to you, so that when you need it, it's going to be there for you. It'll continue to sprout and grow in your life. And with that, I'm going to turn to the specific laws one by one and share some quotations with you that help provide an emotional feeling so you can absorb these laws even more effectively. even though there are an infinite number of spiritual laws because they describe the mechanics and mystery of our existence, I've abstracted them down to 12 laws that apply most specifically and practically to the affairs of human life. Someone else might come up with 50 laws or 7 laws, but I've come up with 12 laws. These 12 laws are the laws of balance, choices, process, presence, compassion, faith, expectation, integrity, action, cycles, surrender, and unity. The first law I'd like to share with you is the law of balance. Now, most of us know, of course, about this law. We know it's nice to be balanced and centered and stable, balanced physically, emotionally, and mentally, even balanced spiritually in some sense. The tricky part of balance is knowing when we're out of balance, because we can't find our balance until we realize those areas of our lives that are out of balance. Sometimes it's very subtle, because anything we do, we can overdo or underdo, and occasionally do just that. Matthias Alexander, a teacher of movement and awareness, once said, "When you're wrong, what's right feels wrong." In other words, when you're out of balance, what's in balance feels out of balance, because we measure the world with a yardstick of our own values. Someone who's an alcoholic may deny they have any imbalance going on, until they say and realize, "I have a drinking problem. I am an alcoholic." Very little progress can be made. And the same is true for a workaholic or anybody who's addicted to any substance, which in a sense is an imbalance. Even what we normally call neurosis is a kind of imbalance. For example, practicing regular hygiene, keeping clean, seems desirable. But if someone washes their hands 40 or 50 times a day, that may represent an imbalance, a kind of obsessive-compulsive neurosis. We all have fears at times. A dog may jump out and bark at us. We may be startled, or may see a large spider crawling on the pillow. Those sorts of things are natural fears. We may jump. But if someone is afraid of any insect, they can't go in a room with them, or afraid to step outside, afraid to go up in an elevator, then we get into the area we call phobic personalities. We could even define neurosis as a kind of imbalance, an exaggeration. Let me convey a feeling for this before we go further in defining balance with a favorite quotation. Thomas Merton wrote in The Way of Chuang Tzu, "The true humans of old, were they cool? Only cool as autumn. Were they hot? No hotter than spring. All that came out of them came softly, like the changing seasons." That conveys a feeling for the balanced life, the middle way, the golden mean. But again, it does little good to talk about balance until we realize where we're out of balance. Some of us don't express our feelings enough. We don't let people know where we are, what we feel. Others of us express our feelings perhaps too much. Again, anything can be overdone or underdone. That's what we need to look at in any area of life where there are disturbances, whether it's with a relationship, whether it's with a health issue. Some people exercise too much. Some people don't exercise enough. Now, of course, balance differs for each one of us. There's no one formula how much everyone should exercise, because we each have different temperaments and constitutions. But in your own life, you need to ask yourself, just as I've done in my own life and continue to do, where might I be out of balance? Maybe. And that's the area to play a game and work the other side too much. And then we come back to that middle way, the golden mean. It's not that we shouldn't explore the varieties and extremes of human experience occasionally, to be very cold or very hot, but we want to come back to that centered place for longevity, for inner peace, stability, and good relations with others. Stephen and Andrea Levine remind us that mindfulness teaches us the nature of the shadow. Heartfulness teaches us the nature of the light. Without these qualities in balance, we will evolve either eyeless in the darkness or blinded by the light. Another favorite quote about balance and how it applies to our lives. There's a Serbian proverb that says, "Be humble, for you are made of earth. Be noble, for you are made of stars." I used to be humble myself, but then I heard another quotation by Golda Meir who said, "Don't be so humble, you're not that great." Made a lot of sense. I received a letter the other day from someone who had read The Laws of Spirit or heard the audio tape version, and they said something very encouraging to me because it was aligned with what I had hoped for the material. They wrote that after being exposed to these laws in the way that I expressed them, they began to see their life through the filter of these laws. And whatever they did in life, they began to see, oh, is this in balance? It's a new way to consider life, not just doing whatever we do, but doing it in the light of this law. And I think you'll find with the following laws as well, that you begin to see life through this kind of filter. And the next filter I'd like to talk about, the next law, is the law of choices, which reminds us, in the words of an unknown sage, there are only two things we have to do in life. We have to die, and we have to live until we die. The rest we make up. It's easy to forget this in life. The law of choices then first reminds us that the choices we've made in the past, whether they were conscious or subconscious, have brought us to precisely where we are right now. Choices we've made, not just the fates, not just circumstances, even though they are often important, but our choices in response to the circumstances we've met have brought us to just where we are today. And in the same sense, the choices we make today, in large part, are going to shape our future. Many of us have forgotten the power of choice. This law reminds us it's time we reclaimed our power to make real choices in life. Many of us feel like victims in some sense. Now, we all know about victim consciousness, and many of us pride ourselves in saying, "I'm not a victim. I take responsibility for my life." Well, I felt that way for a long time, and it was only recent I realized I'm still dealing with subtle issues regarding the law of choices. Let me give you a specific example. In the laws of spirit, the sage, this ageless woman who's teaching me the laws of spirit up in the mountains, turns to me and says, "When you go home, I strongly suggest you ask your wife for a divorce." And I went, "What? Where did this come from? I couldn't do that." She said, "Why not? Of course you can. Just go home, you can call an attorney and tell your wife you're getting a divorce." I said, no, there's no way I'm going to do that. I mean, it would hurt her terribly, and heck, it would hurt me. I mean, it certainly wouldn't be good for our children. Besides that, I want to live as a good example to other people and have a good relationship. It's a spiritual discipline. And, oh, the finances would be a chaos. And I went on and on. And the sage listened patiently and then said, "So, I see, you're trapped." I said, "No, I'm not trapped." She said, "Well, it sounds like it. You're giving me all these very excellent reasons, I'm sure, why you have to stay married." I was starting to get a glimmer of what she was getting at, but it still sounded pretty negative. I said, "Well, no, I don't have to be married." She said, "Well, you're giving me all these reasons you have to be." She said, "Until you recognize you have the power to end your relationship at any moment, today, tomorrow, until you recognize you have the power to end your work, to choose other work, to quit your job, until you recognize you have the power to change where you live, to change your friends, until you recognize you have the power to end your life, whether you have the right or not, let's let the theologians and philosophers debate, but you do have the power. And until you reclaim the power to do these things, until you have the power to say no to life, you are never truly saying yes." Now, when I get up every morning, I may not say this aloud, though on occasion I have, but now I can turn to my wife and gaze at her, and I can say internally, "I choose you today. I'm newly married. I take my marriage vows every single day of my life. I choose to be married to my wife today and tomorrow when I wake up. I'm likely going to choose that as well. You see, I bring a whole different quality of commitment and passion and presence into that relationship that I never was able to in the past. Because I was kind of going through life like many of us do. Well, why am I married? Well, I gotta be. I mean, gee, I got married, you know, I took vows, so I gotta be married. Never fully committing to that relationship, never bringing our whole self into it. Recognizing I have the power to end my life may seem scary and negative. But that means every single day of my life, I choose to be alive. I choose to live. I choose my experiences. So the law of choices reminds us we are absolutely choosing right now in every area of our life. And that opens the door to make different choices if we choose. Now, indeed, some choices, new choices, may be overdue. But sometimes the most heroic choice to make is to choose to be exactly where we are, with full commitment, full presence, and full involvement. And it's a different quality of life. That's what the law of choices is about. Leon Bloom once said, "I have often thought that morality may consist solely in the courage of making a choice." Sidney Howard reminds us that choice means giving up something we want for something else we want more. And of course, Yogi Berra offered this: when you come to a fork in the road, take it. You'll notice as we move through these different laws of spirit that some seem more transcendental and others feel very much down to earth. In reality, all the laws span the whole spectrum from very practical, applicable in daily life, up through a higher understanding. The next law, the law of process, certainly deals with everyday goals and directions. Because if we had no directions, if we had no goals, we wouldn't need to follow a conscious process. We could just wander through life, which some of us have done at times. But when we do have a dream, a goal, a direction we want to go, the law of process reminds us that we can break down any task, no matter how large or imposing, into small, manageable steps. Now that sounds obvious. In fact, it's so obvious, many of us overlook it at times. When we're hiking up a mountain, if we're always looking to the top of the mountain and defining that as success, it can be very discouraging. That represents finishing school or graduate school or getting a degree or training in a sport, creating a good relationship at some time in the future while dealing with various issues that arise today. All these things can be discouraging because the end isn't yet in sight. The law of process reminds us, whatever mountain we're climbing, if we redefine every single small step as a success, then instead of waiting to achieve the goal, the very end, to succeed, every step of the way we go, hey, I just took a step in the right direction. I just succeeded. Wow, I just had another success. And we can have many small successes which will keep us flowing toward the goal day by day, moment by moment, but also keep us encouraged as we make the journey. So the law of process is about enjoying the process. But it's also about making sure that we don't skip steps, that every single goal can be broken down into small, manageable steps. For example, I always feel a little bit sad when I hear a young gymnast say, I'm going to go to the Olympics, that's my goal. Many people think that's a very cute or outstanding goal, and yet that's a very, very high mountain to climb. And there are many pitfalls in the way, and only a few people make it. How much more realistic and encouraging for a child to have a goal of, today I'm going to do a back handspring all by myself, or in the next few minutes I'm going to do 30 push-ups. Small, manageable goals that are right in front of us are far more motivating and inspiring because we can complete them than goals in the distant future that may sound wonderful. Francis Bacon wrote, "We rise to great heights by a winding staircase." And this often reflects the process of our life. Samuel Johnson shared, "Great works are performed not by speed or strength, but by perseverance." Also, another aspect, another facet of the law of process. Ben Franklin tells us, those who can have patience can have what they will. George Bernard Shaw once shared this: I learned to speak as we learn to skate or cycle, by doggedly making a fool of myself until I got used to it. W.B. Prescott spoke of the law of process when he said, in any contest between power and patience, bet on patience. And finally, an English proverb reminds us, often the last key on the ring opens the door. It's almost always the last key in my case. I don't know about you. But all these remind us of the law of process, how to find our goals, no matter what goal you have in life. What goal do you have? I'm sure you have one right now, maybe one today, or a long-standing goal. Maybe a goal you hardly dare think about because it seems too intimidating. But you know what? You can accomplish anything in 10 years. You want to become a brain surgeon? You could do it in 10 years. Step by step, one day, one minute, one moment at a time. That whole process might begin by picking up a telephone and calling someone for information, looking up a number. Every single step is very doable. And that's the key to the law of process. In the laws of spirit, I learned the law of presence from a cat. It was a bit embarrassing at times. And if you've ever dealt with cats, you know what I mean. They have a certain regal air of aloofness and superiority. The law of presence is about living in the present moment, because if you want to have presence in life, you want to be present, fully here. Now, many of us know about living in the here and now. We've read many books and heard tapes and the wisdom of living in the present moment. But how do we do it? Well, there are a number of people who've reminded us how to do it from across time and in every culture. I'm going to share some of those quotations with you, but let me first share why I learned this law from a cat. Cats are masters of living in the present moment. Have you ever tried to scold a cat when it's been up to some mischief? It looks at you like, what? What is it? That was then. This is now. Very difficult to deal with a cat over something that happened a few moments ago, because they're right now, right here. The law of presence serves to remind us that past and future are illusions, powerful illusions, that we keep alive in the present moment. The past is but a memory we hold in our minds, no matter how real it seemed, no matter how accurate it felt. It is gone. It no longer exists in this realm, except in our mind as memory, and sometimes in our body as tension. We can clear that if we wish. We can change our past by changing our memory of the past. The future only exists in our mind, in our imagination, in anticipation of what may happen. It might be very likely to happen. If someone throws a ball to us and we're reaching out for it, it's very likely that ball will come into our hands. But we might miss it. A horn might beep. We might turn our head. A sudden wind may come up. We might sneeze. We never know for sure, even in that situation, what is truly going to happen. We only imagine the future. Now, this is not some kind of dogma, this law. It's not telling you what you should do or shouldn't do. It's fine to look ahead and plan our day. We just don't want to get too attached to the plans, because life has too many surprises. We might want to look back and learn from the past, or nostalgize about something we found pleasant. It's when we're upset. It's when we're troubled with regrets or anxieties or worries, because those things are only about the past or future, not the present. And that's what this cat taught me, to remember when I'm troubled about anything, to bring my mind back to right now, right here. You see, all these laws are different ways of achieving inner peace. We can achieve it by applying the law of balance, by applying the law of choices, by applying the law of process, step by step, or the law of presence. Margaret Bonanno wrote that it's only possible to live happily ever after on a moment-to-moment basis. From ancient Japan, from Hagakure, the Book of the Samurai, there is nothing other than the present moment. When one fully understands this, there will be nothing else to do and nothing else to pursue, because it's all right now. Cesar Pavese wrote, "We do not remember days, we remember moments." Wei Min, a Chinese philosopher, said, "One instant is eternity. Eternity is now. When you see through this one instant, you see through the one who sees." Wonderful reminders across different cultures and different times. But reminders aren't always enough. How do we apply the law of presence? We apply it by practice. You're probably much better at something now than you were 10 years ago. And you can practice living in the present moment the same way. It's a skill, a life skill. We need to become more aware of how we let our mind drift from past to future, past regrets, future anxieties, before we can really apply the law of presence. In a sense, this moment needs to become more interesting to us than what's going on in our subjective reality, in the mind flow, the mind stream. And of course, meditation is one practice in living in the present moment, when we just sit. Thoughts come up, we watch them, we see them go by, we come back to our breathing, we just sit in this moment. Our body lives in the present moment. It's only our mind that flits back and forth. So as we come back to the body, remembering our breathing, and remembering to be relaxed as we can, and to move and do whatever we're doing with a certain level of grace or elegance, that brings us back to the body, back to the present moment. One practical way to apply the law of presence. In talking about the law of compassion, it's easy to sound preachy or suggest to people what they should do to be good, in quotes. Of course, we know it's nice to be compassionate for other people, to be kind. But how do we actually do this? It may be relatively easy for many of us to feel compassion for humanity as a whole, for people we read about in the newspapers and hear about in the news who have suffered pain in their life. We've all felt pain, so that can bring up a sense of compassion in us. But how about feeling compassion for our spouse or our partner, or feeling compassion for our parents, who may or may not have been ideal in that role? What about feeling compassion for the person at work who creates friction with us almost daily, or for our boss? Or for the people who seem to get away with something in life. Or for criminals, people who exhibit cruelty or abuse children. These are the people many of us find the most difficulty feeling compassion for, and are the very people we need to learn to feel compassion for. Now, why do we need to do this? Why not just hate what is hateful? The only answer I can give is that hate and compassion are different energies, and which one would you rather fill up your world? Having said that, though, it doesn't really help. I realize that. Just saying yes, isn't it nice to feel compassionate? How do we do this? How do we find that common ground where we can look at someone and say, there goes a human being like me. There's someone who is going to suffer pain in life and suffer loss of loved ones like me. Someone who's having a tough time, perhaps, stumbling toward the light. When we can remember this, that we're all crew members on Spaceship Earth, doing the best we can, that can bring up in us a feeling of compassion. But in my own experience, I've found that it's very difficult to feel compassion for other people until we feel compassion for ourselves. It begins at home. Carl Jung wrote, "That I feed the hungry, that I forgive an insult, that I love my enemy, these are great virtues. But what if I should discover that the poorest of the beggars and the most impudent of offenders are all within me, and that I stand in need of the alms of my own kindness, that I myself am the enemy who must be loved? What then?" Maybe the difficulty in feeling compassion for ourselves comes from the judgments we place upon ourselves. Whether we're fully aware of it or not, most of us tend to judge ourselves more harshly than anyone else could possibly judge us. Maybe that's why Anne Truitt wrote, "It takes kindness to forgive oneself for one's life." Compassion relates to forgiveness. We've all heard the benefits of asking forgiveness and forgiving other people. But to do that truly, it creates a healing, a shift inside of us. I often ask my daughters for forgiveness. I may be on the phone and they come in and want to ask something and I'll say, "Shh, go away. I'm busy. This is a very important phone call." And then later I'll realize maybe my daughter was just asking me subtly, "Dad, which is more important, that phone call or me?" And I blew it. And when I realize that, even though, of course, children have to learn not to interrupt all the time if you're on the telephone, still, in moments like those, I will often go up and say, "Can you forgive me? I'm asking for her compassion." And you know, it's amazing. My daughters will always go, "Yeah, sure, Dad, we forgive you." Children are so ready to forgive. And maybe we can learn from that. And if you ever ask for someone's forgiveness and they won't forgive you, then you have a chance to forgive them for not forgiving you. Anais Nin said, "What I cannot love, I overlook." Another statement of this law. Alden Nolan once wrote, "The day children realize that all adults are imperfect, they become adolescents. The day they forgive them, they become adults. The day they forgive themselves, they find compassion." When Aldous Huxley was very near his death, there's a story that may be apocryphal about some students who surrounded him and said, "Aldous, after all the spiritual traditions you've studied and practiced for many years, what have you learned?" And he looked up at them and with a twinkle in his eye, he smiled and he said, "I think I've learned to be a little kinder." And perhaps that states, as well as can be said, the law of compassion. It could be expressed in that ancient proverb, "There's God, then there's not paying attention." On the other hand, one doesn't have to have a belief in an external God in order to have faith in life. So often it's been identified, this law, with the religious traditions and a sense of belief. But you know, when a tragedy happens in our life, belief doesn't always carry us through. It doesn't always serve as a life preserver in an ocean of troubles. Faith actually requires great courage, the courage to live our life as if a wise, knowing spirit were guiding our life in every moment. To live as if every difficulty had its own purpose and was for our highest good and learning. And that is a stretch. Now, if we have a flat tire someday when we're late to an appointment, we might be able to draw upon the law of faith and say, "Hey, maybe this will save my life. Maybe I'll get to an intersection later than I could have had a bad accident. I have a flat tire instead." There are many ways to reframe or look at our life in more positive ways. But faith has a more transcendent element. William Clark wrote, "Faith dares the soul to go farther than it can see." Pema Chodron wrote, "If you open to all emotions, to all people, to all situations, staying present and trusting, that faith will take you as far as you can go, and you'll understand all the teachings anyone has ever taught." That gives a flavor for the law of faith, but perhaps there's more to it than that. I choose to believe that when I was born, my soul, if you will, chose every major incident that was ever going to happen to me. I choose to believe that every difficulty, every pain, and every pleasure were arranged by my soul for my highest good and learning. Do I know that's true? No, I wouldn't argue it as an ultimate truth. But I choose to believe it because I can never feel like a victim again. If I face a challenge, I don't have to go, "God must be punishing me," or "How do I deserve this?" or "Why is this happening to me?" and other such unuseful questions. Instead, I can go, "Well, if I chose this on some level, then I might as well make the best of it." Mohandas Gandhi, also known as Mahatma Gandhi, advised us to keep faith in the ocean of humanity, If a few drops are dirty, the ocean does not become soiled. Faith doesn't only deal with faith in the world, or faith in our particular circumstance. It also deals with faith in ourselves, trusting ourselves at a deeper level, in the sense that trusting spirit is working through us, and that spirit is also working through our friends and our adversaries, whether they know it or not, for some much larger purpose. Goethe once said, "Trust yourself and you will know how to live." It means trusting your mind, your emotions, your body. Not trusting the mind to be a vessel for other people's philosophies and beliefs, but trusting your mind to be a receiver, like a radio receiver, that can pick up whatever it needs, whatever information, whatever intuitions. Trusting your emotions and your deepest intuitions, your feelings, and also trusting the body and its instincts. Now, having faith in yourself or trust does not mean you'll never make a mistake. It means that whatever choice you make that is for your highest good and learning, that you cannot make a wrong choice. Someone once said to me, "Well, you know, Dan, I had faith in myself and I once made a decision, and boy, it was a bad one. I mean, I met every difficulty one after the next, hurdles falling in my path. Things just didn't work out. And it was such a tough time for a number of years." All I could respond was, "Does that mean you necessarily made the wrong decision?" In other words, sometimes spirit does put a few hurdles in our path, and faith reminds us that if life puts hurdles in your path, you better become a hurdler. So trusting ourself may be expressed in the words of Soren Kierkegaard, who said, "I found I had less and less to say until finally I became silent and began to listen. I discovered in the silence the voice of God." What if God spoke through you? I don't mean you're hearing things. I meant, what if your deepest intuitions, wherever you choose to go, wherever you step, the path appears beneath your feet. What if that were true? What if everything you look back on you thought was a mistake led you to just where you are now, and a higher degree of wisdom and compassion? Faith reminds you that this is a truth you can live by, one you can create. And when you do that, you stop second-guessing yourself. And that brings us to the law of expectation. The law of expectation is phrased quite well by George Bernard Shaw, who wrote, "Our lives are shaped not so much by our experience as by our expectations." Are we to accept George Bernard Shaw's views at face value? Does it really apply this way in our life? Well, it certainly did in mine. I started kindergarten 3 weeks late, and it was to affect me for quite some time. What happened was this. Our kindergarten teacher had majored in art, so she naturally had the children doing a lot of painting. And before I arrived, unbeknownst to me, she had had the children drawing trees every day. They were practicing drawing trees, and she showed them how the trunk got narrower at the top, and branches grew up, and then leaves grew on the branches. And I didn't know this, my young self, so when I showed up, she said, "Danny, we're going to paint trees today." So she gave me an easel and some paints, and I drew a big stem and a big round lollipop and painted it green. And that was my tree, and I thought it looked pretty good until I stepped back and glanced over at some of the other children's paintings. And their trees had leaves and branches and looked more like the real thing. And I began to form an expectation at that point. "Oh, gee, I'm not very good at painting. This painting stuff, I don't think I have much talent for." I didn't understand that the other children had been practicing longer. Well, the next time the teacher said, "Children, would you like to go paint or go play in the sandbox?" What do you think I was going to choose? Well, I knew I was really good at sandbox. So I ended up going to the sandbox and not practicing painting much more. I didn't get much better at it. And so that's how my expectation began to shape my experience. I became less skilled than some other children because of my assumption or belief that I wasn't as good at it, and we like to do what we're successful at. So you may have certain expectations or beliefs about yourself, that you're not good at adding up checkbooks or hooking up VCRs to television sets. Well, I'd ask you to re-examine those expectations. You may say, oh no, they're based on experience, Dan. I have experience of not knowing how to do something or the other. But maybe that experience came from a previous expectation when you were very young. Many children first feel not very smart in a math class, often when they have to learn dividing one fraction by another, for example. Maybe 2 months later they would have had the mental constructs to grasp the concepts quite easily, as you or I might do nowadays, but they weren't quite ready. Or maybe their teacher wasn't very skilled at explaining it to them in a way they could grasp, and they started feeling dumb. For me, it happened when I had to figure out that famous word problem of two cars are going toward each other at different speeds. I always wanted to ask, why would they want to do a thing like that? So we all have something happening early in life to begin to shape our expectations of what we're good at and not good at. And the law of expectations reminds us to re-examine those beliefs and underlying beliefs. See, it's not about what we think we believe. It's about what we really, truly believe. For example, we may have an expectation, I deserve abundance in life. But maybe deep down, there are issues in that area. Maybe we don't expect abundance. Maybe our parents had a great deal of difficulty achieving it, and we expect, well, it's very difficult to achieve. You change your expectations about life, and you are going to change your life. Alan Keightley once wrote, "Once in a while, it really hits people that they don't have to experience the world in the way they've been told to." Our expectations change the way we perceive reality. An unknown poet once wrote, "Two men looked out of prison bars. One saw mud, and the other saw stars." Two people ride on a roller coaster, one screaming in delight, the other screaming in terror. Why? Well, different expectations, beliefs about that experience. So you can see how our expectations affect our perception of reality, the filters through which we see the world. If you wonder what your deepest underlying beliefs are, the surest way to know is look at your life right now. Your relationships, your finances, your health, your habits. By changing your expectations consciously, you can begin to shift your experience of life. I've seen it in my own life and too many other lives to doubt it for a moment. And that, in a nutshell, is the law of expectations. Although I'm not presenting these laws in any particular order of importance, since laws may change in their significance or importance to any one of us at different times in our lives or different moments in our day, there is a certain flow to them. We talked about compassion and faith and expectations. That leads us into the next law, the law of integrity. You know, I know when I hear about the law of integrity, I go, oh yes, I know it's good to be upstanding and forthright and honest and all that. But the law of integrity is more than that. It's about being integrated. It's about saying what you mean and meaning what you say. It's about having your thoughts, your feelings, and your actions harmonious and congruent. How many of us in our life have felt one thing or known one thing but haven't done that one thing? A common example is in the area of exercise. Many of us know, oh yes, it's good to do a little bit of exercise every day. But our thoughts or beliefs or ideals don't always match what we do. And integrity is indeed about doing what we feel is best. It's not about being perfect, though. It's so easy for people to beat themselves up by going, oh yeah, well, integrity, sure. When I'm giving a lecture and I ask for a show of hands of how many people have had little slips in integrity now and then, my hand usually goes up first, followed by everybody in the room. And often it's a relief for people to look around and see, you mean other people have had slips in integrity? Of course. Because we're all, as I've said, a HIT, H-I-T, a human in training. We're all doing the best we can. We all make mistakes. It's how we learn. So integrity is not about being perfect. But it is about striving to live up to what we can. In fact, Abraham Lincoln once said, "I am not bound to win, but I am bound to be true. I am not bound to succeed, but I am bound to live up to what light I have." I've taken that one really to heart. It's not about success, but it's about living up to our highest light. A woman named Peace Pilgrim, who walked the breadth and width of the United States and Canada 7 times, every state and every province, on foot, talking about inner peace, world peace. She once said, "Live according to your highest light, and more light shall be given." The law of integrity is about being an example, a conscious example, because whether we realize it or not, we are examples to other people. Many of us discount ourselves. We discount our own importance or significance in other people's lives. We go, "Well, you know, what I do really doesn't make a difference. People don't really notice me that much." You know, I was foolish enough to believe that for a long time. I didn't realize how closely some people watch what I do. And I'm not just talking about because I'm an author. I mean, every single one of us are equally important in inspiring and uplifting other people by our example. James Baldwin once wrote, "Children have never been very good at listening to what their parents tell them, but they never fail to imitate them." His words were echoed by Albert Schweitzer, who wrote, "In influencing others, example is not the main thing. It is the only thing." Maybe that's why Edwin Markham wrote, "First commit the golden rule to memory, then commit it to life." Mahatma Gandhi was once approached by a woman who brought her child in tow, and she made the request that Gandhi ask her child to stop eating white sugar, because she said, "Mahatma, he'll be sure and listen to you if you tell him that." And Gandhi smiled at the child and then at the mother and said, "Please, come back in 2 weeks." And the mother looked puzzled, but she nodded and they left. 2 weeks later, to the day, the mother came back with the child, and Gandhi looked down at the child and said, "Don't eat white sugar. It's not good for you." And the mother thanked him and then said, "But Mahatma, why did you wait 2 weeks to tell him that?" And he responded, "2 weeks ago, I was eating white sugar." So again, this rephrases the law of integrity and reminds us to embody what we talk about and talk about only that which we've embodied. The old saying, "Do as I say, not as I do," simply has no impact in life. There are many ways to teach and to uplift other people. There are those on television who preach or write who don't have the same impact as others because they lack spiritual authority. And spiritual authority comes from a life that is lived in line with the law of integrity. Those of us who would like to make a difference for other people in the world need to start by making a difference in our own life, building that foundation of integrity. When we commit to something, we do it. When we know something is right, that's how we act. Integrity is about how we behave when no one is looking, despite impulses to the contrary. The law of integrity leads naturally into the law of action. It's hard to show integrity without acting in life. Now, we all act, don't we? We get out of bed in the morning, we move around, we go to work. Whatever we do, we are active in our lives. But the law of action is more than that. It's about acting in line with what we know is best. Now, that sounds like a restatement of the law of integrity. However, someone can show integrity by sitting quietly, by opening their heart, by living a balanced life. The law of action is about bringing our insides out by expressing, by doing in life, by being an influence in a positive way. To use the same example I gave for the last law, if we know that it would be good to exercise every day, but we don't do that, the law of action reminds us, in the words of French philosopher Duguay, that the smallest good deed surpasses the grandest good intention. The law of action provides the keys for bringing action into life by doing it in very small ways. So often we start with heroic resolutions that fall by the wayside. in areas of diet or exercise or other actions we'd like to begin in our life, good habits. Well, let's say you don't exercise every day, but you say it would be good for me to do that. The law of action reveals the secret: to get up every morning and after a few minutes, do one jumping jack and then go about your day. And the next day when you get up, be sure and do one jumping jack and then continue about your day. Continue this for a full month and beyond. And if anyone ever comes up to you and says, "Hey, by the way, do you exercise every day?" You can say, "Yes, I do. Every single day I exercise." Doing one jumping jack a day may seem insignificant. Obviously, it doesn't give you all your aerobic points. It's not going to get you more flexible or much stronger, but it represents a commitment. Remember, your subconscious, called the basic self in the Huna and Kahuna tradition of Hawaii, gives you your vital energy for life. The next time you make a resolution, it's not just going to go, "Oh, right, another resolution." It's going to remember, we made a commitment to exercise every day and we followed through with it. And it's going to give you more energy to maintain any new actions or habits you'd like to form. It represents a commitment. It gets your foot in the door. Maybe not long after, you'll feel like doing 2 jumping jacks one day. Or maybe doing 10 jumping jacks and going for a little walk. Or dancing to music. Or taking a few deep breaths. But it's a beginning. And the beginning is the key, because once you've begun, you start to dedicate even a small portion of your day to doing some exercise. That's how you bring actions into life. Instead of going on a grand diet scheme or plan, maybe you can begin by eating 1 spoonful of food less each day. Just leave 1 spoonful on your plate. It may not seem like much, but it's a beginning. It brings into consciousness an intention. It brings it into life. Rabindranath Tagore, the Hindi poet, said, "You can't cross the sea merely by staring at the water." Edward Forrester once asked, "How can I know what I think until I see what I do?" Another reminder about the law of action. Andrew Carnegie used to advise his employees, "Pay less attention to what others say, just watch what they do." M.C. Richards once wrote, "Knowledge of the path cannot be substituted for putting one foot in front of the other." And finally, Thomas Edison said, "Most people miss opportunity because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work." All these sayings and proverbs from across history remind us that life isn't lived in a sitting position. Eventually, we are here, inevitably, sooner or later, to bring our highest ideals, our greatest strength, and our courage into life. It may mean asking that person for a date, even though you fear rejection. It may mean making many mistakes and learning from them. Sometimes the wisest action is no action at all. There are times when patience and sitting still and waiting are the wisest action of all, known as the action of inaction. How do we know which to do in any circumstance? Well, there are some clues. If you're somebody who tends to act impulsively, wanting to do things right now, as soon as the thought occurs, maybe the action of non-action could be the wisest course. But if you're someone who procrastinates out of fear or for any other reason, decisive action may be just the thing to try. In any case, if you trust your heart, you will know what to do as each situation arises. Even though I've shared some quotations with you and some principles that clarify the law of action, how it might apply in life, that may not be enough if fear comes up, if doubt comes up, if insecurity comes up that may tend to stop you from acting in ways you know you could if you only could do it. So I want to give an example. First of all, a story about a young gymnast I was coaching at UC Berkeley. She was a freshman gymnast and just learning a new dismount off the uneven parallel bars. And her name was Joyce. And I had spotted her, helped her through the movement a number of times. She'd been in an overhead belt, which supports her weight and keeps her safe and so on. She'd done it many times with assistance, and now it came time for her to do the movement for the first time all by herself. I stepped way back and said, "Here we go." She got up and got ready and was about to start, and she stopped and said, "Coach, I can't do it." And I said, "Well, why not?" She said, "Well, I'm just too afraid." I went, oh, you're afraid. Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, what does that feel like?" She said, "Well, you know, it's like in my stomach's butterfly. I feel weak in my knees and I'm shaky." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I know that feeling. Okay, now let's see it." And she said, "No, I said I was too afraid." I said, "Well, I understand how you can be afraid. Now let's see the dismount." The point I was making was there are always going to be good reasons not to act. There are always things coming up, doubts and fear and so on. But Socrates once reminded me that it's better to do what we need to do than not do it and have a good excuse. That's what life comes down to. That's not a judgment. That's not telling anybody, you or anyone, what you should or shouldn't do. It's just a reminder, another expression of the law of action. So no matter what your reasons for not doing something, no matter what our reasons for not acting, the challenge remains. Wherever we turn, we'll meet the law of action. The law of cycles has a certain natural imagery associated with it. Because when you think of cycles, don't you think of the day passing into night, passing into day, the passing of each season in its own good time? There's a certain patience and serenity that comes in contemplating the law of cycles. Cycles have to do with change, one change into the next, circling round and round. But it's more than that. The law of cycles also points out that in our lives we will experience rising cycles and falling cycles. Any good astrologer knows that we have difficult transits we go through, and they come back every once in a while. Nothing seems to last forever. But we do go through different cycles in our lives. And so this law can actually bring better luck in our lives. We meet opportunity prepared. We have better fortune and better timing. Because when we notice we're in a rising cycle and building, we begin to take advantage of that. Building upon that. Acting upon that. And when we're in a falling cycle, we're no longer frustrated by, why aren't things manifesting for me? Why are things difficult now? Instead, we learn patience, and we learn to wait out the cycle, go inside, learn from it, bide our time until the next rising cycle. Everything has its cycles. So by enjoying the transitions of the day, and there are ways to do that, in waking up in the morning, we can form little rituals to help us wake up, something enjoyable. Maybe it's nothing more than having a little automatic tea maker by our bed, having some warm water when we wake up in the morning, take a few deep breaths instead of just jumping out to go to work. And going to bed at night, having rituals as well that are enjoyable. An aesthetic. Life is an art. We can create a work of art of our life. We forget to do that often. I know I do, but I'm still learning how. The law of cycles is about change. Cycles of change. D.H. Lawrence once reminded us, we are changing. We have got to change. We can no more help changing than leaves can help going yellow and coming loose in autumn. Marcus Aurelius reminded us of the law of cycles when he once wrote, "Time is a river of passing events. No sooner is one thing brought to sight than it is swept away, and another takes its place. And this, too, will be swept away." Truman Capote wrote that life has seasons and cycles, and no hardship can be permanent. I might add to that, no pleasure or hardship, because all things change. But so often we grasp, we cling to what we want. If it's a pleasure, we hold to it. If it's a difficulty, we avoid it. And the law of cycles reminds us there is no way to avoid ups and downs of life. If life is a roller coaster ride, that is as it should be. Who wants to have a roller coaster ride that's all flat? Life is not about being happy all the time. Emotions are like weather patterns. They come and they go. But we can, in applying the laws of spirit, find ourselves riding the cycles of our life much like a surfer rides the waves. And we're not happy all the time, but we can be happier at will by an act of attention, an act of remembrance, that this too shall pass. As we come to the final two laws I'd like to present to you, you'll notice a more transcendent element. We're rising now to the bigger picture of life. And with the law of surrender, I'd like to share with you one of the most powerful secrets I've ever learned in my life. This law could be called the first law of spirit. It's also been called the law of acceptance or the law of flexibility. I need to define what I mean by surrender because to many of us we have a kind of negative connotation or association with surrender as if it means capitulating to someone else's ego or giving up, becoming a victim. But surrender is not a passive endeavor. Surrender is active, creative, assertive. In fact, it's one of the highest principles of the martial arts, which state, when you're pushed, pull. When you're pulled, push. In other words, go with the force of life. Make use of it. But this law has far more than martial arts applications. It can be used even in verbal confrontations. All of us have been caught up in arguments at one time or the other when we have a different viewpoint from someone else. We can practice the law of surrender by acknowledging the other person's point before we push ours and saying, you know, I've learned a lot from this. I really do see your point of view and you may be very correct. And again, there are probably many different viewpoints in this subject. What do you think of this one? That's another way to apply that law in life. No resistance. Dancing with the moment. Because surrender is not about surrendering to other people's views all the time. It's about surrendering to the moment, surrendering to what arises in life, embracing it fully. As Robert Frost said, always fall in with what you're asked to accept. Take what is given and make it over your way. Surrender, then, has nothing to do with passive toleration for what you don't like, or letting yourself be victimized, or accepting injustice. It's making it over your way. The martial art of Aikido or the martial art of Judo are practical applications of this law, and they're very effective. I don't know if you've ever seen that bumper sticker that says, if you don't like the way I drive, get off the sidewalk. Well, that can be a very practical application of how this law works in real life. One person might be walking down the sidewalk and suddenly they see a car coming right at them on the sidewalk and they hesitate for a moment because the first thought in their mind is, you shouldn't be on the sidewalk, boom, and they get hit. Someone practicing the law of surrender instantly responds, slides out of the way, and says, wow, that was a neat experience. I got a chance to test my reflexes. Hey, thanks a lot. Had some excitement today. Sure wasn't boring. That's the way we make over what happens to us. Not a moment of resistance. Stress happens in our life when the mind resists what is. Let me repeat that. Stress happens when the mind resists what is. Life seems to be what happens while we're making other plans. I notice in my own life there's a strong tendency when I have an expectation, somebody says they'll be there at a certain time, and it doesn't happen. I go, wait a minute, they were supposed to be here. They said they would. This is supposed to be happening at this time. Or we go to a movie and the projector's broken. All these things are just shifts in our life. And the tendency is to immediately resist and go, no, this shouldn't be so. Stress happens because we resist what is. When there's no resistance, there is no stress. The law of surrender can be restated many ways. Epictetus, the ancient Greek, said, learn to wish that everything should come to pass exactly as it does. Again, no resistance. Sylvia Robinson wrote, Sometimes holding on makes us strong, and sometimes letting go. Morihei Ueshiba, the founder of Aikido, once said, "The art of peace is invincible because it contends with nothing." Sono, the Japanese poet, advised, "Every morning and every evening, and whenever anything happens to you, keep on saying, 'Thanks for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever.'" Masahide, a colleague of Sono's, once wrote, "Since my house burned down, I now own a better view of the rising moon." These are ways to understand the law of surrender. No resistance, embracing the moment. Surrender is not about always going with other people's views, never stating your own, always giving up your viewpoint. But it can be practiced in little ways. For example, if you're in a disagreement with someone, even a heated argument, once you remember that law, you can go, "You know what? You have a really good point there. I now understand much better what you're trying to say. But, you know, there are probably a lot of different viewpoints about this issue. What do you think of this one?" This next quotation may be a stretch for many of us. It requires a leap to an almost transcendental level of understanding. But Alan Watts once reminded all of his students, "If we live, we live. If we die, we die. If we suffer, we suffer. If we're terrified, we're terrified. There's no problem about it." Do you see how that conveys the law of surrender? Completely going with life. When there's no resistance, when we're in complete relationship with what arises in life, for many people this is tantamount to enlightenment. And finally, in the words of Isaac Bashe the singer, "Life is God's novel. Let God write it." And now we come to the law of unity. This law is quite challenging to express in a meaningful way that can actually help you make changes in your life. Because to understand fully the law of unity, well, that's tantamount to enlightenment. It is a transcendent law that states we are one. Now, we've all heard that. I doubt there's anybody who hasn't heard that phrase somewhere, "we are one," and has considered the idea. It sounds like a lovely idea. Well, that's very nice, we're all one. But the problem is there are different levels of truth, different levels of reality. At the conventional level of truth, we are obviously not one. If I stub my toe, it doesn't hurt you. You don't feel any pain. If I have an emotion, you may not feel the same thing at all. And if I think about something, you may have a very different thought. So at the level of the body and the mind and the emotions, we're not one. We're quite functionally separate. As we should be, because we each are a different aspect of spirit, and we each live our own spark of individual destinies. So, in what sense are we one? Well, when you sit down to meditate, whether you regularly meditate or not, imagine yourself sitting quietly in a balanced position. As you sit with your eyes closed or open, after a while you start noticing thoughts that flow through your awareness. The thoughts come up, happy thoughts, unpleasant thoughts, fantasies, fears, whatever. They drift by and you watch those thoughts. You may notice physical sensations, discomfort in the body, or you're feeling fidgety. You also may notice emotions arising, boredom, wondering how long you've been sitting. Well, the question is, who's watching all these things? Who's watching the body? Who's watching the emotions and the mind? When you say, "I'm going to my house," you are obviously separate from your house. When you speak of, "My body feels good today," who is it that has a body? You may say, "Well, it's my soul or my higher self speaking." You can also say, "I feel my higher self." You can also say, "My soul feels uplifted." Who is it speaking about these things? Perhaps the same you who sits in meditation watching all things arise. Could it be that we are that same awareness, pure awareness watching life happen? Could it be at that level of pure awareness, pure consciousness, pure light, that we are the absolute same light? That we are like many different leaves on a single tree, that we've forgotten we are part of the tree, we think we ended the stem? Could it be that we're like droplets of water falling into the ocean, thinking we're separate droplets, but we are one with the water? At that level, we may be the same. Perhaps we're like light that's refracted through a billion different prisms, forming all the interesting gift wrapping we call you and me. Well, so far, that may be something that makes sense to you. It may be even an elegant idea, and a positive one. But what difference could that possibly make in your life or mine? Well, let me first share two quotations of people from different parts of the world and different parts of time who knew this law of unity as a living truth, not as a concept. Bernard Tetsugan Glassman once wrote, after an illumination experience, "I laughed and I cried as I gazed at a tree. I felt the wind on me. I felt the birds on me. All separation was completely gone." Across the sea, Lord Alfred Tennyson wrote, "All individuality seemed to dissolve and fade away into boundless being, and death was an almost laughable impossibility." It's our destiny, yours and mine, to come to know this truth, to come to practice this law of unity more and more in our lives, so that we begin to see a different reality before us. When I speak before a group of people, and my heart opens, and I'm in that space of unity, I look at all the faces in front of me, and it's like I'm talking to myself. I literally feel as if I'm talking to all these different aspects of myself. Ramana Maharshi, an Indian teacher, once said, "Where there is an other, fear arises." As I speak to groups of people, I wouldn't even know how to be nervous anymore, because there are no others there. It becomes quite humorous in a sense. I'm doing all this talking to myself. Li Po expressed it this way, "We sit together, the mountain and I, until only the mountain remains." The Isha Upanishad, an Indian text, expresses it this way, "Once one has seen the unity, seen all beings in oneself, and oneself in all beings, what room is there for sorrow? What room for confusion?" If other people's successes are yours, and other people's failures are yours, what room is there for envy or resentment? Wouldn't it be a cosmic joke if all those times you were troubled by other people or competitive with them, feeling like they were getting ahead or you were getting ahead, wouldn't it be a cosmic joke if you suddenly realized that those others were you? This may still sound conceptual, but let's look at some practical applications. My father and I were once walking by a tennis court some years ago, and he said to me, "You know, Dan, what I love about the game of tennis?" He said, "Every shot makes somebody happy." And it struck me at the time. I got a kick out of that because it does put you in that space of seeing the bigger picture. Every shot makes somebody happy. We're going to be going through some significant shifts in the coming years before the next millennium. One paradigm shift we will be making is we're going to go from looking at people's differences and emphasizing different religions, different races, different cultures, different skin colors, different traditions and customs. We're going to begin to focus our attention on what we share in common, how we are one in the sense of each of us wants to be loved and appreciated and understood. This has been said in many different ways, in many different traditions. But we'll start to focus on that, what we have in common. Has it struck you that happiness is largely a discipline of attention? If you put your attention on problems and troubles, you feel unhappy. if you put your attention on what gives you joy, you feel happy. Most of the time our attention is pulled to that which makes us unhappy, our problems, unfinished business, our differences. The more and more you let your attention shift to what do we have in common, if you're having an argument with someone, if you feel divisiveness, if you feel someone has a different point of view that's quite different from yours, refocus on what you do share in common. This is one way to apply the law. And to use another sports analogy, another shift of consciousness that will happen is we're going to change from a competitive perspective to a cooperative perspective. If we are all one, if all human beings are cells on the same body of earth, every cell needs to flourish more and more before the whole earth will flourish. Wouldn't it be silly, your kidney thinking it's in a competition with your liver, that it wants to do a better job and shine more? When we see ourselves as cells in the same body, it's another way of looking at the law of unity. Henry David Thoreau once wrote something that I never understood until I saw it in the context of the law of unity. He wrote, "Some of us go fishing all our lives without realizing it is not fish we are after." The drama that happens in the attraction between different people to one another, love and sexuality, magnetic attraction, is only a small sample of what can happen when all of humanity are drawn together, when we treat everyone like a brother or sister. Someday, at some point in time, we will look back on this era that we had so many thousands of laws and punishments to keep people in line. And as we've noticed, it hasn't worked altogether. There will come a time when we will need very few human laws or punishments. There will come a time when people begin to trust the laws inside them and live by the laws of spirit. And the more humanity begins to abide by the laws of spirit, the fewer external laws and punishments we'll need, because we will know what to do and how to behave in any situation. Humanity is still growing out of its infancy into adolescence. We have a ways to go, and we'll take it step by step, one law, one human being at a time. Let it begin now with you. In closing, let me share some of the final words in the Laws of Spirit. The sage was saying farewell to me up in the mountains after teaching me these laws, and she said to me, and I say to you, these are my wishes and prayers for you all the days of your life. May you find grace as you surrender to life. May you find happiness as you stop seeking it. May you come to trust these laws and inherit the wisdom of the earth. May you reconnect with the heart of nature and feel the blessings of spirit. Even when the sky appears at its darkest, know that the sun shines ever upon you, that love surrounds you, and that the pure light within you will guide your way home. So trust the process of your life unfolding, and know with certainty through the peaks and valleys of your journey that your soul rests safe and secure in the arms of spirit. The challenges of daily life will remain, and you'll tend to forget. But a deeper part of you will remember, and when you do, life's problems will seem no more substantial than soap bubbles. The path will open before you where before there grew only weeds of confusion. Your future and the future of all humanity is a path into the light, into a growing realization of the unity with the Creator and all creation, and what lies beyond is beyond description. So be guided as I have been guided, and know the peace of God.